Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After each episode, you can connect with others in the sarcoma community on our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to delve deeper into the episode's topics. You can find information on this specific subtype or your subtype, as well as all our podcast episodes on SFA's website, www.curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. Follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on the latest episodes. Thanks for listening. On this episode, we speak with Mike Cacioppo, who was diagnosed with osteosarcoma in 2021. Mike shares his experience of being a part of the sarcoma community as well as the amputee community and how advocacy for both has become a part of his life. He also talks about parenting while navigating a sarcoma diagnosis and how he maintains an optimistic mindset through all of the challenges he's faced. A big thank you to Mike for sharing his story. Let's dive in. Welcome to the Sarcoma Stories podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Tasha Nathan.
And hi, everyone. I am Brandy Felser.
And today we have our guest, Mike. Mike, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Mike Cacioppo. I am an osteosarcoma patient.
Awesome. And Mike, I was thinking as I was getting ready for the podcast today, it is almost 3 years since we first met at the Race to Cure Sarcoma, which was Boston's inaugural race. And do you remember what you said to me during the survivor ceremony, or what we said to each other up on stage at the survivor ceremony?
We'll see you next year.
We'll see you next year. And here we are almost 3 years later. Exactly. And I think that was pretty symbolic because you were heading into your treatment for the second time the day after that race.
Yep.
So I figured we could start off with a little background of how you kind of got to that point with your initial diagnosis.
Yeah. So I was diagnosed with osteosarcoma in my right foot in the fall of 2021. So, you know, first diagnosed just a, you know, small bump on the outside of my foot, you know, that didn't really go away. So eventually I was like, why don't I get this thing checked out? I'm sure it's nothing. It was not nothing. And so that's where it all started from there. Started chemo in November of 21, and had my amputation in, February of 22.
So I just want to backtrack just a little bit.
Sure.
How long did you have the lump before you actually went to the doctor? And then how long did it take them from your first trip to the doctor to figure out what this was until you found out that you had an osteosarcoma?
So I probably noticed it in the summertime, maybe July of that year. But then going back and kind of thinking about things, there were times that I got up in the morning and just stepped out of bed and was like, ow. Why does my foot hurt? I probably did something at the gym. It's whatever. I'm 41, you know. It was whatever. It'll go away, and didn't go away. And then so from my initial X-ray, which was September of 21, to diagnosis, whole biopsy and everything was probably about a month. Things started moving very fast. After I got my first X-ray that said suspicion of a growth in my heel, got that followed up with an MRI with my physician. As soon as they saw the MRI, actually the orthopedist who read it was basically, I don't see this very often, but I'm pretty sure this is cancer. So I'm going to refer you to the orthopedic oncologist. And it went very quickly from there. Again, from reading the MRI to biopsy to chemo. Chemo started when I got diagnosed in September.
I had a question also about the amputation.
Sure.
Were there other options that they presented to you?
Yeah, so there were pretty much no options, especially where it was in my heel. Basically, the orthopedist was like, well, we could scoop it out, but then you can't use your foot. So, you know, and that was only if it was benign after the biopsy, which he pretty much was like, this isn't benign. I know what this looks like, you know, and I remember him saying, or maybe it was the PA saying, sunburst pattern. And then, of course, my wife Googled sunburst pattern, MRI, and osteosarcoma came right up. So, there was really no option. We have to take this foot.
I saw where you said also the challenges with being an amputee and a cancer patient, because most amputees are not cancer patients.
Correct.
You're kind of in two different communities. You're part of the amputee community, and then you're part of a cancer, of a sarcoma community. You know, how do you bridge those? And what's that like being part of the amputee community as a cancer patient?
It's kind of tough, to be honest with you. You know, and I try not to be, you know, too cynical about it when I'm talking with other amputees. Like in my head, I'm like, you don't ever have to worry about your, you know, like if your limb is going to grow back or not. You know, it's not, but you know, it was trauma, you know, like you're just dealing with that. And of course there are complications with amputees and all that stuff that goes along with it. But there's never in the back of the mind, like there is with cancer patients, like, is this going to come back? And for me, it has multiple times. So I think if I had to choose one or two, who do I connect with more? It's probably more of the cancer community that I connect with than it is the amputee community. Talking with Tasha, like I can talk about, you know, what I'm going through with chemo or what I'm going through in my head, like of all the things that cancer patients think about on a daily basis. But then is in terms of like being part of the amputee community, last year I started working with a group for advocacy for getting activity prosthetics covered by private insurance companies. Mm-hmm. It's a bill that's kind of being talked about in all over states in the country. And here in Massachusetts, it's called So Everyone Can Move. And it's, in that regard, my cancer survivorship and my amputee life kind of go hand in hand, because my whole point is, as a cancer patient, I know how precious life is and like how I just want to be able to do whatever I can, whenever I can, for as long as I can. And with insurance companies not covering things like a running blade or whatever other activity prosthesis you can think of. For me, it's a running blade, obviously. For some people, it's a yoga arm or, you know, whatever people might need to live their life as fully as they want to. So that's how I kind of combine the two communities.
There is that relation to people like Tasha, who's not an amputee, but she also has to worry about recurrences. And so that's a whole different kind of a conversation to connect with someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something I think Mike and I, you and I talk about a lot, because I think we hear from each other every single time one of us has a scan. And there is a comfort to that of saying like, hey, friend, I'm going into my scans, and I don't have to say literally anything else for you to be like, okay, here we go. You got this.
Exactly.
And I'm going to hope for good news when you come out. I know you've mentioned before that you're in this age bracket where you're not necessarily an older adult, but you are out of the age bracket for adolescent young adult. And there is an isolation in that space as well. Could you talk a little bit more about what your experience with that has been like?
Sure. There's not too many osteosarcoma patients with white beards. It's just not the way it goes. That's tough. You know, it's where do I find a connection? And sometimes I don't find one. Sometimes I'm just kind of like, again, just kind of floating out on my own, where I don't have like a support. I don't know older osteosarcoma patients. I don't really know many younger ones either, for that matter. That's kind of tough. you know, you see all these posts about young adult camp or like young adult get together, and it's like ages up to 33. I'm like, well, I passed that a long time ago. So, you know, it's just one of those things that you just kind of like, eh, I guess I'll just figure this out on my own.
One of the things you also mentioned before is reoccurrence. As someone who had gone through reoccurrence, what is that experience like? Because from my position, I can imagine it, but I don't know exactly what it feels like. I know many people listening can either relate or resonate with that fear.
I would say the first word feeling that pops in my head is exhausting. It's exhausting. You know, you get through one range of treatment, you start living your life again. And then for me, my first reoccurrence happened about 18 months after I completed chemotherapy, if I'm remembering that right. So I was trying to get to that 2-year mark from diagnosis, and it was like, oh, 6 months away. Mm-hmm. 6 months away from that magic number of 2 years, you know. So then, you know, had to start chemo again, and you have to go through the mental gymnastics of trying to, you know, get yourself, you know, not psyched up for it, but get yourself mentally ready for the next trudge through treatment. So for my first reoccurrence, again, we did surgery. I had 2 lung nodules, which is how osteosarcoma recurs. Is not necessarily another bone tumor. It's more lung nodules. Mine first showed up as 2 lung nodules. We removed one right away, and then started another chemo regimen that I had to actually end up stopping. I was supposed to do 6 cycles. I ended up doing 4 because I got very neutropenic, like had a really bad infection, had, you know, got admitted to the hospital. And so my doctor was like, well, you know, we have to, you know, weigh the pros and cons of continuing this treatment. Like, I can't say that, you know, like we should keep doing this if this is what it's doing to you. So we stopped treatment then. Time is hard to keep track of. That was July of 23 that we stopped that treatment. Then, you know, went through all of the rest of 23 fine, and then January of 24 they found another lung nodule. Again, you know, that was one. It was small. I know there's many osteosarcoma patients who their lungs presentation are full of nodules. So I know that I'm fortunate in that regard. Relatively fortunate, I guess, is how we you know, part of the mental gymnastics of being a cancer patient. I started that oral chemotherapy in February of 24. And then had the nodule removed this past September. And I'm still on the oral chemotherapy, and no new nodules have been discovered since I started that. So, you know, again, that's a positive, right? The battle is trying to grab those silver linings or those positive things that you can attach yourself to make it through that struggle of dealing with, here we go again.
It's those mental challenges that you are weaving your way through. And as you said, grasping onto the positives so you can stay positive about the situation that you're in. How do you do that? Are there resources that you use? What advice would you give to other people that are cancer patients that are doing the exact same thing?
It's a good question. Sometimes I'm not quite sure how I do it. I don't necessarily do meditation. I don't necessarily do one specific thing or seek out, like, you know, support groups. I literally try to find, what am I grateful for today? And if I can find just those, you know, just one thing to pull me out of whatever hole I might be feeling in. And don't get me wrong, there are days where I'm not getting out of that hole. And you just kind of like trudge through it. I think exercise helps a lot. You know, if I'm feeling really, really down, like I think a good hard workout as best I can, you know, physically whatever the limitations might be, whether it's with, you know, with my leg or with energy or whatever the challenge is, I try to just kind of push through it a little bit. I mean, I have a great family that helps a lot. And then talking to people like Tasha, like when you can kind of bounce off that crappy feeling to someone else and they're like, I know what you're feeling. And you don't get the, you can do this. You're so tough. You can do this. And because that is like, I don't want to hear that. I have to do it. I don't want to do it.
And it's interesting you say that, because when you're being told you can do it, oftentimes you know you can because it's the only option. So I know for me, when people told me you can do this, I was like, yeah, I know I can, because if I want to live, this is my only option. I have to do it. So yes, I can do it. But what you're saying is like being able to say to somebody, wow, I'm having a hard time getting out of this hole today. And the response not being encouragement, but rather validation is everything when you need to get out of the hole. And when you can't find the gratitude, it's maybe that thing that is the gratitude in that moment. Maybe the gratitude is like, I felt understood today.
That's a great way to put it.
You know, it's interesting to hear this conversation because I often look back with the learning curve I went through with my mother's situation. And I really am taking heart what you said, Mike, of you don't necessarily want to hear you can do it, right? You know you have to. And I learned throughout my journey being the caregiver to my mom was I would tell her, you have to do this. You have to eat. You have to get up. You have to do it. And I've learned so much. Even just doing these podcasts, I've learned so much hearing from others. I was not understanding that her mentality, and I'm not here to be your coach. Right? I'm here to be your support. And those are two very different things. And it was something that I learned a little too late. But it was something that I was having a discussion with someone a long time ago, and a light bulb went off. And you just reminded me of that, Mike. I think from a caregiver standpoint, we feel like our role is, okay, I got to get you to the doctor. I have to get you to eat. And I have to get you to get up and move around. And you know, I'm here to be your cheerleader and make you feel positive. And when you're feeling down, I'm here to lift you up. When in reality, what I've heard time and time again is that's not really what people need. Sometimes it's just, you know what? Yeah, this really stinks.
And I have to give it to the caregivers too, because Randy, I've heard you say this. I've heard the caregivers in my life say this too. And it's hard to know. First of all, as a patient, it's often hard to know what you need in the moment. And there's a lot of people asking you what you need. And you're like, I actually don't even know myself. I'm trying to figure it out. So I have to give it to the caregivers too, because we're all just trying to figure it out. Nobody really knows what they're doing in the moment. And so much of this is in hindsight and through lived experience. But Mike, I know you've said before how supportive your family is and your wife. And I'm curious if you could maybe guide the care partners listening to this of what she has done that has been helpful for you as a care partner.
I would say like from the jump, she was the one doing all the background work while I'm just sitting in this catatonic state of trying to digest what I've just been told about myself. She's just jumping into it, like finding resources, finding people to talk to. Okay, this is the plan. This is what we're going to do. And I work best when I do have a plan and when I do have information. So in that way, she knew how to jumpstart things for me. And, you know, just like knowing when she needs to be like, needs to protect me from myself. Like if I'm trying to do too much in that way, just having my back, but knowing when to be, you need to just go sit down and I'll take care of the rest.
And you also have two sons.
I do.
And we often talk about a cancer diagnosis being a family diagnosis and the impact that it has on the whole family. And how has your son's been able to understand and support you through this? There's a lot of parents who have been diagnosed with sarcoma that have children. You think about how do we tell them? How do we integrate them? Do we integrate them? Do we protect them? How do we have that conversation and the impact that it could potentially have on them?
Yeah.
How have you been able to handle that as a family?
So that was definitely like the hardest part in the beginning. When I first got diagnosed, my children were in sixth grade and fourth grade. So you just got childhood snatched from you. But at the same time, we wanted to be as honest as we could to a point, to the, you know, level of not totally scaring them, but also this is what I'll be dealing with. But we've also kept it pretty normal in my house as far as you still gotta go to bed when we tell you to. You still gotta do all the things that you're supposed to do. And at this point, they've seen me through two IV infusion chemos and now this oral chemo. But this oral chemo, I have my hair. I don't look like a cancer patient, quote unquote. And I don't know if that's helped them in a way as well. They know when I'm going in for scans. And at this point, it's almost normal for them. It's just part of my life and our life. I think staying normal, you know, keeping that consistent normalcy, we're still cooking your vegetables, whether you like it or not. At this point, too, it's they just kind of live their life. We're just living. We're just living.
Keeping things normal is a theme while you have cancer. In my treatment, that is all I wanted was normalcy. And so it's interesting to hear you talk about parenting in that way, because I think that's also a lot of what we crave when our life gets turned upside down is normalcy, and that being helpful both for parenting and for the person going through it.
Yeah, totally.
You mentioned that you said we're all just living life. We're still living life. I'm interested to know, how has life changed for you? And I ask that in the question, the concept of a lot of cancer patients go through chemotherapy, they get their surgeries, and circling back sort of to the beginning of this conversation, how your life is a little bit different because you also suffer from an amputation. And so how has it impacted your life, and how have you said, okay, I'm going to live my life and it may look differently, and this is how it may look different?
So, of course, as a cancer patient who's still in treatment and being monitored, we live our lives 3 months at a time. So I try not to even project out as far as this is my 5-year plan or something like that. I don't even, of course, that's what we think about. No, we have to still prepare for that. But at the same time, I just live my life in 3-month increments, basically. But as far as the, you know, with the living with the prosthesis, like the only real things that I can't do is go for a, you know, a hard jog, but hopefully I'll get a running blade. You know, I can't, you know, I, but other than that, I mean, I'm still working. I'm still doing things in my house, you know, cooking, you know, going to kids' sporting events, you know, playing basketball in the driveway, you know, things like that. And that's just how I kind of live my life. And the other thing is, mentally, I know that nobody knows what tomorrow might bring. And once you kind of have that perspective, like, yes, I know that on my next scan, there could show a lung nodule. But someone who's not under surveillance or, you know, or a cancer patient could have a heart attack tomorrow. And so it's almost like you have to live as if your diagnosis is going to change tomorrow. Not always easy to do, but that's kind of how I kind of live my life. Just keep living.
It's great because I think people who find themselves at the beginning of the journey, what you give them is hope that your life, yeah, it changed, but I'm still doing all of these things.
Yep. I'm curious for you, when you first received news that you'd be going through an amputation, was there that question of like, will I be able to do these things that you're doing now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When I first heard amputation, like, I was like, my life is over. Like, my career is over. Like, so for my work, I'm standing a lot. You know, so it was just like, oh, my career is over. My, you know, my life might be over. You know, everything was just crumbling down. And actually, this goes back to my wife kind of doing a lot of research, and she found this woman on Instagram. And she was awesome. She got on a FaceTime with us, and what advice she gave me was, all the things you're doing now, I promise you, you'll do them again. It's going to be different, but you'll do it again. So I got my prosthesis in July of 23. July of 22. And that Christmas, I was up on a ladder, like, putting up my Christmas lights. And that's what popped in my head, was that, like, comment, like, you will do everything that you've done before, just going to be different. And this was me being a bit more careful on the ladder than I had been in the past.
But you did it. And what was that feeling like doing this? I guess if you've never been through an amputation or a cancer diagnosis, seemingly mundane path. But what was that like for you, putting up Christmas lights after your amputation?
Yeah, it was awesome. It's such a basic thing to do. I climbed three steps on a ladder, and I'm hanging my lights up on the porch over my house. But that small thing, again, going back to that normalcy thing, it made me feel normal. Mm-hmm. So that gratitude thing, it just being grateful for climbing up a ladder and putting some lights up. You know, that just helps help my mental state to kind of just keep going, keep living.
Yeah. And I can hear the emotion in your voice as you talk about it. And I think it's something to point out to listeners who are maybe in the early stages of it, or quote unquote in the thick of it, to seek those moments out. And sometimes they seek you out. You're not even intentionally trying to find the gratitude, but it comes to you. And that's where the hope comes from. And I think that's something you and I have bonded over. The number of times you and I have texted each other of like, oh my gosh, I know you'll appreciate this. This just happened. And we're just like elated for a very mundane, basic thing. That's where the hope comes from.
Yep. And that's a great point. Like, because about not necessarily seeking out the gratitude, but just like a moment hits you and you're like, oh, this is pretty cool.
When you said you were climbing a ladder of lights, I'm like, what? No. I would have been don't do it. It's not that big of a deal. We don't need Christmas lights. It's not that important, right? And not understanding for you how important it was. This was something that made you feel like you accomplished something normal. And it would never have occurred to me how that was such an important moment for you.
Totally. And especially since that, like, the Christmas before is when I was in, like, you know, 2 months into, you know, the full MAP chemo and like really feeling terrible and like, you know, really depressed. So to be on the other side a year later, again, doing something as mundane as putting up Christmas lights, that was that like, all right, she said I was going to be doing the things that I did before, and I am.
The two of you first met at our Boston race. What made you want to participate in that?
I think number one, community. We talked about that earlier. It was finally a chance for me to be like, oh, there's other people with sarcoma, different types of sarcoma. I mean, just learning how many different types of sarcoma there were, you know, as a patient, you know, navigating osteosarcoma, it's like, oh, well, there's all these other sarcomas. So I think what made me want to do it was number one, community. Number two is fundraising. You know, I, you know, just knowing how little has changed in the treatment of sarcoma for so long. That's also what kind of got me to want to do that as well. I was going to go, you know, for a personal best during the race or anything like that. It was more just like, let's go meet some other people.
Yeah, most people don't go for their personal best. I would say that.
Just there for the community. I can tell you that day, I did not expect to walk away with a friend like Mike. And I will never forget that moment on stage, Mike, because I think in your fundraising page, you had wrote that you would be starting treatment the following day after the race. And I had read that. And so when we arrived, I kind of knew who you were. And we were standing up there. We're both emotional and like tapped you on the back. And then we looked at each other and said, I'll see you here next year. And I, you know, that was a moment for me too, because I had just finished treatment and was like, where do I go from here? And both of our journeys were at this pivotal moment, and just meeting someone who is a complete stranger, but when you're standing next to them on that stage, you know exactly what they're feeling, and then leaving that and being like, let's stay in touch. I just want everyone to come to a race for that. If you do nothing else, to walk away with feeling less isolated and more supported by someone who gets it.
Yep. Yeah, it was a pretty powerful moment. For sure.
And then you came back the following year. You had your third recurrence at that point?
Okay. It had been re-diagnosed in January of 24, and the race was April 24.
So we came back, Boston's second year, our second year. You were our survivor speaker. When we talk about recurrence and we talk about living life still and all of the things you're still doing, is that for somebody out there, you are a symbol of hope. And I know we've talked about it being like unintentional inspiration, because even through recurrence, which again is another moment where it's my like over, what is going to happen from here? You're still living life. Life can still be lived, even with these limitations.
Yeah, it might not be the life that you want, but it's what you have, and whatever you can do to keep moving forward will help you just continue your survivorship. Like that's what like the word itself, survivorship. That's what we're doing every day. Is just by living our life, we're surviving. I struggle with that word survivorship, and I think I put that in my speech at the race. When I think survivor, I think I'm fully cured. I'm just out there, you know, back to doing whatever I want to do. And then I think talking with you about that term survivorship, it was not the end result of your cancer journey. It's throughout, like from diagnosis to the rest of your life, that you're surviving. Or change that word around a little bit. That helped me keep going every day. Maybe there are days that you just want to be like, oh, this again. But I'm still here. And you know, going back to that unintentional inspiration, that's sort of like what we talked about before, is, you know, I don't want to be someone's inspiration, but sometimes you don't have a choice. It's not sort of a weight as much anymore. I got to be the thumbs up guy. I got to be smiling through chemo. I got to do all these things to inspire other people. It's not so much that as much as it is you're inspiring people by just living your life. Just doing those mundane things is how you're inspiring people.
You said earlier, some days I'm just not feeling positive.
Yep.
And I think that's important for people to understand, is it's okay to have bad days. It's okay not to be the thumbs up person. It's okay when somebody says, how are you feeling today? I'm feeling pretty crappy. That's how I'm feeling. And giving people the space and to understand that it's okay. Because I do think that there is a sense of, again, I go back to what I said about coaching, right? Oh, you can do it. You got this. Everything's going to be great. And then you feel like you have to always be positive through it.
Yeah, because there's an immense pressure when you go into being a patient to be the quote-unquote good patient, and the thumbs up and the positive and the inspiration. I think this is something I realized. The act of just living amidst a diagnosis is greatly inspiring to the other people around you, kind of like you said, Mike, of just participating in life, and seeing you do that pushes me to do that. And then when I do that, it pushes you to do that. And I hope for somebody listening who feels like the crushing weight of their diagnosis can feel that from us as well, that encouragement. And then maybe someone who isn't experiencing a diagnosis, maybe it teaches them to look at putting the Christmas lights up differently, you know, or whatever it is. what a gift. And I think that's where that inspiration piece comes from. And like we keep saying, like, it's not the word, but maybe it's perspective. It's just perspective or something. That, you know, that's all.
That's a great point, because I use that word a lot. Like, somebody would be like, oh, my back is killing me, but I don't want to complain to you. Like, you're allowed to everyone's allowed, like, everyone's got their own stuff that they got to deal with. All that I can offer and cancer patients can offer, survivors can offer, is perspective. Like, is whatever you're dealing with temporary? Is it something that you can figure out a way to push through? Like, what, you know, and I think that's where people draw that inspiration from, or you know, that, you know, I think just it's just, for me, I know that the word inspiration and pity have like a really fine line. And I don't want to be pitied. So if you pick one, I guess I'll take inspiration.
I feel like we have in the cancer community often is the language, words around survivorship, inspiration, what people like to be labeled as or don't like to be called. It's not anything I thought of until I was diagnosed. And I remember saying to people in my life who went through cancer diagnosis before me, like, you're so strong. And once you're in the position, you're like, I don't feel strong today. Like, and it's just the language around it. It is an important conversation to have.
How do you have that conversation? That's what I wanted. You use the term strong, Natasha, on these motivational pages for people who are going through it. And you see that word strong used a lot. And I wonder how, from someone who's living the journey, how do you have that conversation with someone, going back to not having to be the thumbs up guy? How do you tell someone, I am strong, but I'm not strong all the time, and that's okay. I don't always have to be strong. I don't always have to be the thumbs up person.
So it really depends on where you're hearing it from, right? If it's kind of like friends of friends, or, you know, like in my community, it's like, you know, neighbors or whatever. Oh, you're such an inspiration. Thank you. You know, and then you just kind of like, it's just almost small talk at that point. But then when you have your closer friends or your family, I've definitely gotten the, oh, you're such a warrior. And I will blatantly say, I don't want to be. I don't want to be a warrior. I don't really feel strong today. So I think it literally is who's saying it. Where are you hearing that from? If it's your family and friends, you can probably be pretty direct and say, thank you, but I'm not feeling it today. And maybe that helps them say, well, what can I do to help you then? Is there something that I can do to sort of get you out of that? And sometimes the answer is no, nothing, but thank you. So I think that honesty with your friends and family, the people who are with you all the time, I think is super important.
Thinking about all the things that we've discussed, you know, sarcoma is an isolating diagnosis simply because it's rare. And it's not always easy to find a community. And then you are now in a situation where you've been diagnosed with osteosarcoma, which is hard to find a community because of the age that you are. And it's not usually diagnosed in someone your age. And then you also have the amputation. And so it's interesting to me to see, I hate to call it like this, but like a triple whammy in a sense of, here you are with a rare cancer and then a subtype where it's rare for you to have, and then an amputation that's rare for cancer patients to have. How do you reconcile all of that?
Well, I usually say, you know, I wanted to make it into the 1%, but not this way. That's mind-blowing, like, trifecta of, like, well, I've never won the lotto, but I won this unlucky lotto. You know, how did this happen? So, you know, the absurdity of it, like, this is an absurd, I mean, I make a lot of jokes about my leg. I definitely try to balance the overwhelming sort of weight of that, you know, trifecta with humor. It's really, The only way I can dig myself out of it sometimes, to be honest.
Mike, for people who have just been diagnosed and are starting their journey, what advice would you give them?
Oh, find your why, right? You've just been given a life-altering diagnosis. Why do you want to keep going? Why is this not going to stop you from living? Why are you going to face this thing head on and deal with it? And whatever happens, happens. But finding a way, it goes back to sort of the mental gymnastics. You have to be the Simone Biles of mental gymnastics and really get into your head and because, you know, so much of cancer, we focus on the physical effects of chemo, the physical effects of an amputation. But really the biggest hurdle is your mental state. I won't say it for anyone else. Like I'm not going to project on somebody else, but for me, I had to find a way mentally to deal with the physical. And by getting to a point where, like, okay, this sucks, but tomorrow's another day. Like, let's get through today. We'll see what tomorrow is. That would probably be my best advice for anyone dealing with a situation that nobody wants to be in.
Take it day by day.
Yep, that's pretty much it.
You mentioned earlier in our discussion that you were doing some advocacy work. And I'm interested to know, and I do want to mention the bill so everyone can move. But from a sarcoma perspective, from an understanding public policy and advocacy through the work that you're doing, what do you think is one important public policy change that would benefit sarcoma?
That's a good question. I don't know what the sort of the research grant money looks like for sarcoma, but you know, I always find it sort of a bit demoralizing that in order to get research for a cancer like sarcoma, you need to raise money through like fundraisers or like private means. There's no football Sunday in October where everyone's wearing yellow ribbons. Let's try to get some bigger money into this research. If we can't find a cure, then let's work on better treatments that prevent recurrence, or at least the probability of recurrence is lower.
So yeah, increased research funding.
Yeah.
SFA is the largest private funder of research in the sarcoma community. We give out the most research to support specifically sarcoma. Government does give out research grants for sarcoma. Could that be increased? Absolutely. And it absolutely is a public policy priority for SFA and should be, as you said, for the whole sarcoma community, because we do need to increase research funding. Do we get as much as you mentioned, the bigger cancers? No, we do not. Do we need to get more? Yes. And do we need to raise awareness? Absolutely. One other question I have is, obstacles that you face throughout your journey. Are there any obstacles that you face throughout your journey that you had to overcome that you thought this, it'd be great if this was changed?
Yeah. Well, I'm very fortunate in where I live and the hospital systems in where I live, that I could find a sarcoma center. I would say for me, what I wish I had a little bit more sort of, understanding of is what the amputation process was going to be like, because it was pretty much like, yeah, you're going to get an amputation. Now I'm going to hand you over to the oncology doctor, and you guys will kind of take it from there. But there was no real discussion of, well, what do I do after I have this amputation? I had to kind of seek out that information as for like finding a prosthetist. Where do I go? Finding physical therapy. What's that look like? So for me, as an osteosarcoma patient with the amputation, that's sort of where I felt disconnected. in that process.
Could I ask you how you knew to go to a sarcoma center? Were you referred to one or you should be at a center?
My orthopedic oncologist or orthopedist who is in oncology, whatever he was, my surgeon, he was the one who referred me to the sarcoma centers.
Great. That's good to hear. That does not always happen with people.
That's part of the education and awareness piece is to go to a center. That's always what we encourage and recommend. Like, we have talked a lot about community. And for those listening, if they would like to connect with you after this episode, where could they do that?
You can either connect with me on Instagram. My Instagram name is MikeC829, or email. It's the same, MikeC829@gmail. Help anybody out with whatever I can sort of pass along to them as far as what I've experienced in my journey.
This episode will also be posted in the Facebook group that we have for Sarcoma Stories. Instagram, email are the best way to reach Mike, or come to the Boston Race to Cure Sarcoma.
That's right. I'll be there with Tasha.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Mike, for being here today and for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners. To amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients, SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatment and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link.